Good afternoon. This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Coming up on today's show, Shahbaz Tazir and his wife Mahim. Shahbaz Tazir is from a prominent family in Pakistan known for their courage and stalwart opposition to the spread of extremist ideology. Almost 5 years ago, Shahbaz was kidnapped and held for nearly 5 years in captivity by the Taliban. He and his wife came to town as guests of the Marshall Direct Fund. The Marshall Direct Fund is named in honor of the Marshall Plan, just as George Marshall recognized the great need to invest in war-weary people and ventures abroad. The Marshall Direct Fund seeks to provide the same opportunity to invest in people who are in desperate need of educational and economic opportunities so that they can choose peace and prosperity over violence and despair. Marshall Direct Fund was founded by Sylby Stainton, who studied international security at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at DU. I began by asking Shahbaz to tell us about the day he was abducted.
So I was just basically going to office. I have a company, a real estate development company, which I used to head. And it was just a normal day. I'd come back from Dubai. I had some work. I'd come back and, casually driving to office. And suddenly, I was attacked by five armed gunmen, and I thought it was like an armed robbery, so I just got out, gave them my car keys, I had a watch, I took it off and gave it to them, said, look, just, let me go, take the car, buy some money, just, and, it happened so quickly, they just put me in their car, and as we drove away, he said, I've come for you. And that's the first time it sort of the realization dawned on me that, this is not an armed robbery. It's a lot more serious than that. It could be a possible kidnapping, or they could be wanting to kill me because of the stand that my father took, which was that he defended an innocent Christian woman who was accused of blasphemy in Pakistan. He was actually the governor of Punjab, which is the second largest province, but economically, it's the largest province in Pakistan. So he was a very, very senior member of the government at the time of his assassination. And so basically, he was fighting against these draconian, outdated blasphemy laws in Pakistan, and he was calling for these laws to be amended. And funny enough, some of the ulema, which is Islamic scholars inside of Pakistan, who called for my father's murder and applauded it, are also calling for these amendments, saying that this law is law is outdated. The only problem is that Salman Taseer called it a black law, which baffles me. But it is an outdated law. It does need amendments. And so that's what my father was doing. What at the time we didn't realize was how incredibly scary the situation in Pakistan can get, but my father was fearless in his defense of this woman, and I think he knew the danger a lot more than I think we even comprehended it. So he died, but I think he knew that he would, and I think he was ready for it. He it didn't bother him. He was ready to take this stand and he said, I will fight till I am the last man standing. And hopefully he's not the last man standing. I hope ordinary Pakistanis like myself can carry that torch.
There was no increased security in your life. You hadn't been aware that there was a potential threat against you?
We had been getting a lot of threats as a family. And we had asked continuously for security. But I only had one guard. And that guard had been assigned to me when my father became the governor of Punjab. And
let me ask really quickly, is that a normal occasion just as a family like yours to have security or because of your father?
I think it's not normal for an ordinary family to have security, but it's also not normal for the situation that my family found itself in after my father's death to have so little security. So I think it's a bit funny. Obviously, for me, I thought one guard is enough. But obviously, it wasn't. I was traveling that day without a guard.
Oh. So
I don't think the guard would have made very much difference because the former Prime Minister, Yusuf Raza Gilani, his son had guards with him. but he was attacked on a political campaign and kidnapped regardless, and his guards were shot to death. So, you know, these people, they act very quickly with complete impunity, and it's, you know, you can't expect where the next attack will come from. I mean, what happened to me is, it's not the same, but, you know, they can carry it out in France. They can do it in America. It just takes one radical, violent person to do something horrendous that nobody's expecting. And that's what happened to me. It's just one violent person who wanted to extort me just struck at a time where I wasn't expecting it. And I don't think anyone can ever expect to be ready to get kidnapped for 4.5 years. It's crazy.
So go back to the day you realized fairly quickly that it wasn't just a carjacking or a robbery. They put you in the car and took you.
So they put me in the car, and like 10 minutes in, they injected me with this drug called ketamine, which is, I think, a horse tranquilizer. I don't know, but they injected it in my arm, and I passed out. And they continuously did this for Friday and Saturday.
To just keep you completely
out. To keep me
out.
Completely unconscious. And while doing this, they were beating me violently. When I woke up, it was sometime on Sunday, and I was on the motorway between Lahore and Islamabad. And I just remember waking up on the motorway feeling very claustrophobic because I thought I was in a bag, but actually what they'd done is put a hijab on me, which is a dress that Muslim women wear to, you know, cover themselves. And by 7 o'clock in the evening on Sunday, I was in Waziristan. And so I knew that I was lost. No one was going to find me. It was impossible. I could see my surroundings, the people that I was with, just how they were walking. You know, they were all armed. And I didn't know where I was. So I asked continuously, where am I? They kept saying, you know, you're in Afghanistan. And I might as well have been. It's a lawless, lost, forgotten place, and very dangerous. And it seemed like all the crazy militants of the world had sort of gathered in this one place. Mm-hmm. And so the first feeling that one would get finding themselves in this situation is of complete hopelessness. But I think from that first minute when I came into Waziristan and I was conscious and I realized what was going on, I just told myself, you have to be very strong. You absolutely have no choice. I didn't even know what was going to happen, how I was going to stay, how they would treat me, nothing. But I just knew that whatever happens, I have to be very strong.
I want to turn for a moment back home to Maheen. When did you know?
I think we knew almost instantly because it happened right outside his office.
People saw,
yeah. And then his office was informed. So we knew instantly. And then obviously everybody rushed there, and the police and everybody else gathered. And first we just thought, you know, that we didn't know what was going on. So we thought perhaps even if it's a kidnapping, in my mind, I thought maybe it's nothing more than a few hours or maybe like a day or two. Little did we know that it's going to be 4.5 years.
How quickly before they start negotiating for your release? And was it about ransom or was it about release of political prisoners?
The first thing that they said, I think they communicated with them sometime in October. So the first thing that they said was...
Go back to what day this began?
This began on the 26th of August,
okay.
2011. And
okay.
So sometime in October that year, I think is the first time they made contact with my family. And they were very clear they wanted a ridiculous sum of money and a release of 25 militants. And they kept saying the message was for the government of Pakistan. And that's how it was. It was just 4.5 years of me basically smashing my head against a wall trying to explain to these people that, you know, it's been 4.5 years. No one is going to give you this ridiculous amount of money. And no one is going to release any, you know, militants as well. If it was going to happen, it would happen in the first 6 months. The more you delay this, I mean, I will be forgotten. One government has changed, the other one doesn't care. And that's what we're going to find ourselves in. So, I mean, it was pretty hard to deal with someone so arrogant and blinded by greed, because that's what it was. It was just they were blinded by greed. They actually kidnap people because that is the source of revenue for most militant groups to work. And so what they don't realize is that it's you know, you're taking someone's life. It's, you're just taking years from it. But the tragedy is they don't care. Time is of no matter to them. They don't, these things don't affect them. So, you know, they torture me, they humiliated me to pressurize a government that I don't think cared, and put a lot of pressure on my family who couldn't do anything. It was probably like the worst sort of situation to find yourself in.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. My guest is Shahbaz Tazir and his wife, Maheen. Shahbaz is a Pakistani businessman and the son of the former governor of Punjab, Salman Tazir. In August 2011, following his father's assassination, Shahbaz was kidnapped by militants in Lahore while he was driving to his office from his home. His captivity lasted nearly 5 years, and he was released only this past March. Tazir was in Aspen as a guest of the Marshall Direct Fund. The Marshall Direct Fund's mission is to invest in education and women's economic empowerment for a more peaceful world. Tazir's family have been longtime supporters of the Marshall Direct Fund. Were you given access to news sources at all? Did you understand what was happening in the...
No, so I didn't know anything till I think about Jan 2013, where one of my guards supported a soccer team, the same soccer team as me, which was Manchester United, and he would sneak a radio into my cell and we would listen to these games. So it was actually the first time in a year and a half that I got any kind of news. But the amazing thing was that it lasted for a few years till, you know, November 2015, when the Afghan Taliban actually attacked this Uzbek group and killed them and then took the living, whoever was left, as prisoners. But till then, I had this unbelievable window in this very, very dark place where I had something amazing to look forward to, which was just listening to, you know, sports, getting some kind of, you know, news about what was going on in the world. I mean, I remember in 2013, February, I found out that Colonel Gaddafi had been killed in Libya, and I was in shock because I found out so late. And, I started hearing about the Arab Spring, right, and, you know, how the Egyptian dictator had been. I mean, it was too much information coming in at one time. But, I mean, just to imagine for a year and a half, I didn't know anything. I was completely dependent on my kidnapper, and he would usually lie to me.
And it was one man over and over?
No, so he was an important commander inside this group, but he took sole responsibility for my kidnapping and to sort of broker a deal, right? So, you know, even the head of that group, he would tell, don't interfere in this, I will finish this job. This is my responsibility. So that's what it was. It was just this one psychotic person who took 4.5 years of my life.
Did they feed you regularly?
No. So I was fed once a day. It got harder and harder because, they basically starved me. The purpose was to just break me mentally and physically, to humiliate me to a point where somehow I would be able to pay this money or free these people. And regardless of how bad the torture got, and yet nothing was happening, they wouldn't believe it. They would just say that it's a matter of time before we break him. And once he's broken, then the government or his family will break. But I think my only victory was to not allow them to do that to me. Physically, I couldn't stop it, but mentally, at least I could control my situation.
Tell me about the home life then.
It's so hard to explain because it's such a prolonged trauma and you're just constantly in one state. So 4.5 years was literally just that. And I think it's the uncertainty where you don't know what's happening. They would send us torture videos of him, and there were months where we had no proof of life. So, I mean, we had to just take each day as it comes and just keep the hope alive and pray and get the kind of help that we could. But obviously, it was really difficult. And no matter how hard you tried, it was just a really helpless situation. You know, how do you go to these places? How do you reach out to these people? There's no logic. They're, you know, inhumane. They're barbaric. You can't really talk to them. How do you negotiate with them, you know? So it was just years of just a lot of pain. But I guess you found solace in prayer and just tried to just keep the hope alive and hope that he's okay. So any news we would get, our first instinct would just be that at least he's alive, at least he's okay.
Did you try to go back to a relatively normal day-to-day
routine? It was really hard for the first 3 years. I couldn't. And then, of course, with family support, you know, they were like, you have to work, you have to try and go out. And so eventually I did. I started work. But of course, it wasn't easy.
Did that make you feel guilty?
It did. I think in the beginning, everything would, whether you're eating food or whether you have a bed or whether you're having a Coke, you know, everything would make you feel so guilty. But like he was surviving, I would always tell myself that if he's being brave and surviving, then I guess that's what we have to do here, you know, survive the best that we can.
Were you able to get, they would give your family torture videos, were you ever able to communicate directly with your family or your wife?
I think I spoke a few times. I spoke to her twice, two, three times I spoke to my mother. But the wonderful thing was that they would bring me their Twitter to show me how they didn't care, right? To show me, look, they're liars. These people are messaging them. Oh. But for me, it was just beautiful because I would see what these guys are up to every day. And I would see their pictures and I realized that my mother and my wife, my sister, my brother are refusing to give up on me. And even though it had been 5 months or 6 months since we spoke, since any kind of proof of life, they would still, you know, pray. And it wasn't just them. It was like thousands of people from all over the world who I didn't know. I'd never met them. And they were just praying for me. This person messaged me. She was a Christian woman who lived in America, and she said, I went to my church and I told, the people there what had happened to you and the stand that your father had taken. And even though you were a Muslim, we had a ceremony for you. And when you came back, we were so happy. We all sang songs and prayed. And I was just thinking, wow, I've never met these people. How can you feel that need to pray for someone constantly for 4.5 years, who, by the way, might be dead. There's no proof of his existence. But, you know, that's what I think always gave me strength for this time, to just see my family never give up. And then it made me realize I can't ever give up. If these people don't give up on me, how can I ever give up on the thought of going back to them?
Did you have days where you wanted to give up?
You know, there was a time, and it was, I think, 2012, the torture had gotten really bad. I used to think that they're going to basically just piece by piece tear me apart. And I was in a really dark place. And I remember I was sitting there. And so my kidnapper walks in and, you know, throws this piece of paper, this printed Twitter piece of paper at my face and says, look, you know, your family is celebrating an infidel. And I didn't know what he's talking about. So I think it was sometime in 2013. So I look at it and Nelson Mandela had passed away, and my sister had written a little tweet, and she said, prisoners of conscience are always free. So if you're listening, you're free. And oh. I don't know what happened, but I got this incredible strength, this need to just one day be able to tell her I was listening.
Oh my God. I've got goosebumps. This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. My guest is Shahbaz Tazir and his wife, Maheen. Shahbaz is a Pakistani businessman and the son of the former governor of Punjab, Salman Tazir. In August 2011, following his father's assassination, Shahbaz was kidnapped by militants in Lahore while he was driving to his office from his home. His captivity lasted nearly 5 years, and he was released only this past March. Tazir was in Aspen as a guest of the Marshall Direct Fund. The Marshall Direct Fund's mission is to invest in education and women's economic empowerment for a more peaceful world. Tazir's family have been longtime supporters of the Marshall Direct Fund. When did you become aware of that political event and the uprising of ISIS, or the creation of ISIS?
So the group that I was with, they were so violent in their ideology that they could actually never relate to the Pakistani Taliban or the Afghan Taliban, regardless of how violent these groups are. They were not violent enough for them. When ISIS came in the picture, these guys, they just clicked. Mm. It was immediate. They could see, you know, oh, these videos, this is just exactly what we do. You know, putting prisoners in orange uniforms, you know, humiliating people, killing masses of, you know, people because, you know, calling them infidels or whatever. I mean, this psychotic, violent ideology appealed to them. And they were one of the first groups to secretly give a pledge of allegiance to ISIS. And ISIS themselves, Abu Bakr Baghdadi, who is their leader and has, you know, made himself the caliph of the Muslim world, which, by the way, as a Muslim, I refuse to accept, asked for these Uzbeks. He said, in order for me to be successful in Afghanistan and India and Pakistan, I need this group. And so they gave a pledge of allegiance almost instantly when ISIS was formed. And so what they didn't realize was that by giving this pledge of allegiance to ISIS, they've completely delegitimized the Afghan Taliban. And that didn't go well with the Afghan Taliban, who were like, well, if you've gone this way, there's only one way. It's our way or we fight till the death. And that's what happened. And actually, that's what led to my release, this violent five-day war between the Afghan Taliban and the Uzbeks, where the Afghan Taliban killed, you know, over 100 women and children and, you know, 50, 60 armed Uzbek men. They also killed so many more in prison. It was ruthless. There was, you know, it was just the most barbaric thing that I've ever seen. And somehow, in the middle of this, I survived and was taken as a prisoner, by the way, who they said was Uzbek. They kept telling me, you're Uzbek, you're one of them. Regardless of me saying, I've been kidnapped by these people. They refused to believe that. So then I was sent off to another prison with the people who had taken me captive.
Maheen, did you all know that this was happening?
We had no idea. So we hadn't heard from him in 5 months.
Oh.
And so we found out when he came back that he was actually being held prisoner and he was in an Afghanistan jail. We knew he was in Afghanistan, but we didn't know that this was happening.
So you had to convince your captors, who were the new group, that you weren't part of the Uzbeks.
Yeah.
That was the most difficult thing.
Yeah, the first thing wasn't even convincing them that I was kidnapped. The first thing was convincing them I'm not Uzbek. Mm. and they didn't believe me, by the way. They sentenced all of us to 6 months to 2 years in this Afghan Taliban jail. Inside that jail, I actually met a guy who helped me get out of the jail, but I had to find my own way from Rozgan all the way back to Quetta in Pakistan. And it took me 8 days, but I mean, when I look at it now, it was totally worth it.
Did people help?
Actually, the Taliban helped. I told them that I was a Taliban from England and I needed a ride to Quetta, so I gave them some money. And they.
How did you have money?
The guy who helped me get out of jail, he gave me 5,000 rupees for fuel and food and 10,000 rupees that once you make it to Quetta, find your own way back.
How much is that? What is that, the equivalent of?
It's about $150. Not bad for someone who's being extorted.
So you got money from them?
Yeah, I got money from them. Not bad.
So I can't imagine the first contact, the phone call. Or however you contacted your family.
Got to this place, Kuch Luck, and I had forgotten everyone's numbers except my mother's. So I called her and
those
I said...
stupid smartphones.
Yeah. So my first thing was, Mom, don't speak to me in English because my immediate reaction is to reply in English. So try speaking to me in Urdu, though. My Urdu is very weak. I only speak English. So anyways, she just said, who is this? I said, I wonder how many people call you from the middle of nowhere and say, Mom, help me. So anyways, they were in shock because...
Did you really say that
no,
like that?
I just always make fun of
them. I don't think you had time to say that at that point.
No, but what was crazy was that, you know, 4.5 years of this hopeless situation, I'm telling my mother I've run away, I need help, pick me up from this, you know, town. And she wouldn't believe it. She called my wife, Maheen. She called my younger sister. She called my brother. She called my uncle. And she said, I don't believe it. So don't get your hopes up. We'll try to, it might be a trap. You know, that's how hopeless our situation was. That even though I'm telling her I'm, you know, I'm free, they wouldn't believe it. It's so...
Until she had you in her arms, I'm sure, Maheen, you've... probably yeah. felt the same way.
Yeah, I mean, it just, it seems surreal because it's a day that you think about for so long and then it was happening. And it was scary because they used to lie to us so much. In the middle, once they told us that he's been killed in a drone strike. So they would play these games with us. And we thought maybe this is another trick because we couldn't imagine that he would escape those, and he would escape, and just he was in Afghanistan, so how he would make it here. But I'm so glad that he actually did, and until we knew that he was safe, we were scared.
And this is all 4 months ago, 5 months ago?
Yeah.
4 months, yeah.
So March 9th.
29th of Feb, I left that prison, and I think the 7th of March, 8th of March, I called these guys, so it took me a few days.
But you seem remarkably adjusted.
You know, you should see me using a smartphone. You realize how actually lost I am. But I used to tell myself that my biggest challenge will be to adjust. I used to actually hear these shows on radio as well sometimes if I ever got the opportunity. And I heard this amazing story about this guy, this U.S. soldier who was in Vietnam, and then he suffered from post-traumatic stress. He had been taken captive and tortured by the Viet Cong. But, you know, his wife was talking about how people never knew that this guy had post-traumatic stress and it destroyed him. And so this story hit me and I was like, you know, maybe this will happen to me. It could, right? He was a soldier. He was prepared for this. But I heard another wonderful story, and I was telling Jody about it, that, you know, the three women in the basement who were kidnapped by this Cuban guy, and I heard their story, and it lifted my spirit, because I was like, they were raped. They were in this impossible situation, you know, kept in a basement for years. And somehow, you know, a miracle happened and they got out. They got freedom again. So why can't I? Why can't it happen for anyone? And you know, so it was these small things. I would hold on to them and just tell myself, you can, you know, it's a struggle to be normal, but, you know, it's not that difficult. It can be done. And you can do it alone. So the challenge to adjust is always there, you know. Everything had changed when I got back. My friends were married with children. You know, friends who I didn't even think would get a date were married with children. You know, my younger brother, my younger sister were married. It was, you know, it was a beautiful shock. I didn't take it as something, you know, negative. I just looked at the positive. It's so wonderful to come back to so much happiness in other people's life. And all these wonderful people, whether it's my wife, whether it's my mother, my friends, they've just helped me so much to adjust that it makes it so much easier. I wish somebody would help me with the smartphone, but, you know.
It just takes practice.
Yeah.
And you have a blessing on the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. We're really excited. Yeah, it's something that we always wanted. We were planning actually before he got kidnapped, but I'm glad that it's happened now. And in happy times, and we can celebrate the right way.
Well, congratulations to you all for
your
blessing, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. If you missed the show or would like to hear it again, go to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Have a great afternoon.